our African brothers and sisters, and I should say at the very beginning that they send their love to all the Christians in Australia. Their warmth of greeting me and was very emotional. Tremendous sense of love and gratitude that I would come and live amongst them, and also be able to bring gifts of Bibles and hymn books to meet their need, because they certainly have a great need. Now, Rita, we're going to what time did you say? About 10 to 9. Well, I think it'd be nice just to have a brief reading from the Word of God. And one of the things that really came home to me over there was the value of prayer, because it was a little bit of a frightening experience for me to leave Australia at my age and go to live among the people. It was an unknown thing, unknown quantity, but I proved the Lord, and I believe that the prayers of many of the Lord's people were answered. Many were praying for me. Just reading from Ecclesiastes chapter 11, it says, "Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days." Now, we sometimes get a little bit discouraged in our service for the Lord, especially when you're sitting at a computer for weeks on end, writing and editing as I do. And as you, most of you know, I'm the editor of Facts of Faith. I have been for the last 14 years. In some way, one of our magazines found its way into the southwest corner of Kenya. That's one of the older issues, and that's our new format. We've upgraded it this year to the 21st century. And so it's encouraging for all of us to realise that as we serve the Lord, we may not always see results at that time. In fact, we may not even see the results in this life, but if we keep sowing faithfully, there will be a harvest. And we're told to cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. That's a wonderful promise. The psalmist says to they that sow in tears will reap in joy. And that is a future day when we're going to be in the presence of the Lord, and what a joy it's going to be to see the results of our labours for him. And we need to realise that we are workers together. And particularly valuable are your prayers. You may not be able to do what I can do, and I can't do what others can do, but we can certainly pray. We're told to give a serving to seven and also to eight. In other words, we're to give a portion, and we're to do it now. We have opportunities today that we may not have tomorrow. We can see what's happening, for instance, in Zimbabwe at the moment. And that is likely to spread to other African countries, even to Kenya. They're concerned in Kenya. I received a letter today from Irish Outreach, Brother Gillett, and he was unable to do very much in his recent visit to Nigeria because of the tensions that the Muslims are building up. They're burning homes, burning churches, and they're killing believers. And in the northern states, the Muslims have declared their Muslim law, and the persecution is really on. So the door may be closing in the northern parts and perhaps more of Nigeria, and this may even come to Kenya. So while we have the opportunity, we need to avail ourselves of it. Give a serving to seven and also to eight, for you do not know what evil will be on the earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. And so the importance of our heart condition. If our hearts are right, if we are walking with the Lord, if we're walking in the Spirit, there will be an overflow. Just as the rains pour from the clouds that are full of rain, there will be an overflow from our hearts as well. Verse 4 tells us, "He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap." In other words, there will be difficulties. We're not to be deterred by them. Having the conviction that what we're doing is of his will, we should continue in it. As you do not know what is the way of the wind or how the bones grow in the womb of her who is with child, so you do not know the works of God who makes all things. And we need to have confidence in God that he will bless his word. God will bless his word if we have confidence in him. And after all, as Paul said, one sows, another reaps, but God gives the increase, doesn't he? And it is his work. In the morning sow your seed, and in the evening do not withhold your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, either this or that, or whether both alike will be good. And so that is a little encouragement for us to be diligent in serving the Lord in our own corner, wherever we are, whether it's as you're getting older. Some of you may not be able to do as much as you used to, but remember the importance of prayer, to pray for the Lord's servants and the various fields and the various work that is being done for him, and to do what we can in our corner while we can. 2 years ago I received a letter from a chap in southwest corner of Kenya called James Onwandu. Somehow or other he had received one of our magazines. I don't know how. Don't know how he got it. Magazines have been going into Nigeria for some years. We've been sending them in free, as we do, to overseas third world countries where they request them. Most of them are very poor. They can't afford to pay for them. And we've also sent some into Ethiopia. And Ethiopia is probably the poorest country, or one of the poorest countries in Africa. And it's interesting that Kenya borders on Somalia to the north, and that border is closed. The rebels along the border, it's a very dangerous area, so you just don't go into that area of Kenya along the Somali border. And then to the west of that we have Ethiopia, and then bordering on that we have the Sudan, and then swing down to the south we have Lake Victoria with Uganda. And then to the south we have Tanzania joining on to Kenya. And where I was able to visit was in the southwest corner, within 100 miles perhaps square of the Tanzanian border, Lake Victoria, in that area. And in that area, not only did I receive a letter from James Onwandu 2 years ago, but when I began to pray, he began sending photographs. You'll see on here some of the photographs. You won't see them from back there, but maybe later on. And this is James Onwandu, and that's the first photograph he sent me. And about the second letter, I began to send him more magazines, and he kept writing back asking for more, and he began sending photographs of the believers. And I was able to contact missionaries in Kenya. I asked for contact with Assembly Missionaries. I actually emailed Wendy Strachan, and she put me in touch with the Reardons. Rex and Dorothy Reardon are the Emmaus. Rex is the Emmaus director at the Emmaus Bible School in Nairobi. A wonderful couple. Without their help, I would not have been able to achieve what I did, or it would have been very difficult. And so Facts of Faith sent over some money. It was only $200, but Rex was able to go down and visit James Onwandu. He took an African brother with him, Marco Wakuzi. And Marco is actually Ugandan, but he is a very studious man. He actually takes radio programs in Nairobi, which are broadcast throughout the nation. And they're hoping to set up a radio station soon, operating from Emmaus. And when they got down there, they met James, and they baptised James and a half a dozen, or I think it was a dozen believers. It was the beginning of a nucleus of a new work, and they gave out Bibles on our behalf. And we were amazed at the amount of Bibles that he was able to buy with the $200 that we sent over. So that was the first contact. Now that was only October last year. By this time I was really praying, because James kept writing saying, the whole church is praying for you to come over. Now it was the last thing that was on my mind, to go to Kenya, I can tell you. But as this correspondence continued, I came under a deep conviction that perhaps God wanted me to go, and so I began to pray about it. And then I came to Romans 12, 1 and 2, and I said, well, Lord, I'm presenting myself to you as a living sacrifice for this area of service. If you want me to go, I'm willing to go, but you have to make it plain to me. And the conviction kept growing, and I got a letter back from Lex saying how these James and the other brothers within, to the best of their ability, were trying to carry out New Testament principles. I had sent them the Emmaus course, Christ Loved the Church, which is one of the best that I know of, to teach the New Testament principles that assemblies generally hold, and also our Facts of Faith, a list of books. We have my own book called The New Testament Church, which is a brief study on the same principles, and other books that I'd sent across to him. So they were attempting to follow this teaching. And so I began to really pray about it. I even went down and made some inquiries about airfares, and when I did that, I didn't have any money towards it at all. And this is getting into late October. And then I went and got a price on airfares, and then I received a letter in the mail from another chap who didn't know James Omwandu, but he had somehow got one of our magazines, and it must have come through James Omwandu and through another chap back to him. And his name is George Cecil, and George wrote saying that they needed Bibles, they needed Sunday school materials, they wanted me to come and teach them the Word of God. And so I sent him an Emmaus course, Christ Loved the Church, and I said, look, these are the things we believe. If you really believe that this is what the Word of God is teaching, well then we're interested in trying to visit maybe and help you. And he wrote back to say, please come. And I just felt that that was the clincher. So I went down and booked my fare to leave at the end of February for 3 months on a 90-day visa. And in a wonderful way, the Lord provided that. He also provided me with enough money to buy a small four-wheel drive, because this is a very isolated area. You just can't get into these places without a vehicle. I also, when I arrived in Nairobi, Rex met me, and we went shopping. We bought Bibles. I had gifts given me for Bibles. I bought my own camp stretcher. I don't mind camping out. It's part of my background. I don't mind roughing it a bit. Bought a folding table, folding chair, a little kerosene stove, and the old hurricane lantern, mosquito net. I took one with me from Australia, but I doubled up to make sure, because malaria is a big problem. And of course I was pretty concerned, and Rex and Dorothy later, they didn't say it at that stage, but Marco said, we've been very concerned about you going down into this area because of the malaria. It's the mountain sickness, they call it, and it's a bad area for malaria, and also cholera, although there was no cholera there at the time when I was there, and typhoid. James nearly died of typhoid. He had to sell his only milking cow to save his life. That's how poor they are. And but I want to tell you that the Lord protected me all the way. Not one mosquito got through to me that I'm aware of. My daughter's called this mosquito landing pad here. I can remember one night, one landed, but he took off in a hurry because I had a pretty thick application of Bushman. I don't know, you've probably never seen it, but it's a very, very strong 80% DEET repellent that is made in cans for very heavy infestations of mosquitoes. I got onto that, so it really kept them at bay. So I had to take all these precautions. So I went down there, and Marco Wakuzi actually travelled with me. It's about 300 or 400 kilometres. The roads, the main roads in Kenya, are not too bad. Most of them are sealed, although they're not always very well maintained. You'll be cruising along at 70 or 80 because you don't go much faster, because people walk both sides of the roads. They walk across the roads. Nairobi is an experience. People just crossing everywhere. The matatu, that's the little taxis. They pull up in the middle of the road and they get out the wrong side. And it's quite an experience. A bit of a cultural shock living in these places. But I adapted to that. And Mark and I drove down the roads. One section of bitumen, the worst section, was 9 kilometres. It took me over 30 minutes to get through that in low and second gear. Just huge potholes. They are rebuilding that section of Kenya down near the southwest corner. I found there was a full-time worker there, an assembly brother, Daniel and Damaris Oching, and their little boy, who's only less than two, Dennis. He's an African worker, commended from the assembly that meets at the Bible school in Nairobi. And I was able to go firstly to there with Mark Marco. I had a weekend of meetings with them, and that assembly is 2 years old. I've got about 30 in fellowship. We had very good meetings. And then on the Monday, James, I'm one to come in, and it took me an hour and a half. I said, James, how far is it? Oh, he said, I think it's very hard to understand his English. I said, he said, it's about 80 kilometres. I said, how long? An hour and a half. Well, he was right about the hour and a half. It was 23 kilometres and took me an hour and a half in low gear, and some places in four-wheel drive. And the little Subaru that I bought, an 89 model, loaded down with Bibles and my gear, bottoming out at different places, but the Lord again protected us. So I had 2 weeks of meetings with James at a place called Nigashio, and there I found a wonderful response. Leaders came in. Now they are very poor, and my African experience began because they kept coming to me and asking for things. In other words, you know, when they see the white man, they think, here is the money. And it's quite an experience to have to face this and to learn how to handle it. Because I'm underneath, I'm a fairly soft fellow, and when you see needs, it's very difficult to say no. But they kept coming to me with different needs. And one of the problems was that they didn't have food to feed the leaders. James was, and his church were reaching out. People were getting saved. There's one brother there, Isaiah. I'll just give his first name. Isaiah has a shamba, that's a little farm. All these people are self-supporting. They have their own little farms and might be only 1 acre, 3, 5 acres. They grow their maize and their beans, and they grow a few peanuts. They call them groundnuts. They might have an avocado tree. Some of them have bananas and a few pawpaws. You can buy things like tomatoes and onions along the roadside in different places. I was able to buy pineapples. But there's not a lot of variety, and of course they have very little cash themselves. But Isaiah, he has a shamba, and he leaves his wife and his family, and he walks for 4 hours, 3.5 to 4 hours, and he started a new work at a place called Rianya. And I was able to get to Rianya. It took me an hour and a half over atrocious roads to get in there. And gave out Bibles, and I had meetings there, and in less than 12 months there were some 15 to 20 in fellowship, and I didn't go to preach the gospel, but people were just getting saved. For instance, at Nagasha, I was just speaking, and we're sitting out under the gum trees. Remember, no, hardly any buildings. We're out among the gum trees, the expatriates. I'm an expatriate over there, and the gum trees are expatriates. About the only trees around. There's very few African trees left. And so the meetings are under the gum trees, and I'm sitting there, and there's a road below me, and mine is the only vehicle that's been over that road for years. They had to dig rocks out, they had to rebuild a bridge to get me in, and these brothers, they really worked very hard for me to get in there with the vehicle. They put weeks of work in. James actually quarried through rock to get the car down to his house. I had a job to get out. It was that steep. But the amount of rock and the trees they moved and the work they did, he moved out of his house for me to move into it. And later on, when I saw how they were living in their little grass hut beside their old house, this is a little circular mud hut with a thatch roof, and they're all trying to squeeze in there, I said, you move back in. So they began to reuse one of the bedrooms. This was a little mud hut, 3 rooms in it, with an corrugated iron roof, and all made out of bush timber. Very, very rough, but that's their home. So I got into Rianya, and I spoke there at 2 meetings in the day, and Isaiah stayed on over the weekend, and he walked back Monday. He said 11 more were saved that weekend at Rianya. And I would be sitting there at Nagasho, people walking along the road below me, and a little path above me, walking past. And I saw a lady walking along, and I don't know why, I just said, you know, there's a lady in the Bible who reached out to touch the Lord, and her life was changed. Why don't you reach out and touch the Lord? She just stopped, turned around, sat down, and later on they led her to the Lord. When I didn't really go to preach the gospel, but these were just situations. I went to another place where they started a new work, and the brother there had got very sick with kidney trouble. He was unable to carry on. They send a man in to shepherd these new believers. Wherever they get a little group, they're sending a man in to do it. And they'd sent a new younger brother in there, only 2 years, a young brother, 2 years in the Lord. His name is Thomas. And while I was there, They have that work is less than 12 months old. There's probably about 15 or 20 in fellowship there. And they asked me just to go up and visit the house next door. A family recently saved. The brother wanted me to go up. And when you go in, and when I arrive, wherever I go, they have a big welcoming ceremony. And that can go on for a half an hour, three quarters of an hour. And they sort of kept it up every day. And in the finish, I had to take them aside and say, "Now look, James," I said, "I'm from Australia. I've come a long way. And I appreciate your hospitality and the welcoming. But you're going to have to cut back on this because I'm here to teach the word." And they would introduce all the elders, and this brother is a faithful brother and he's a deacon, and this sister is a faithful sister, and now would you like to say a word, and would you like to say a word, and this could go on for anything up to an hour. Then it's my turn and I carry the greetings from the Christians in Australia, and I have my little talk, and then we begin the meetings. So I went into this house and we did the usual greetings, and then it was my turn and we had a little prayer, and I read with them from the scripture, and I was ready to go, and my interpreter said, I had an interpreter everywhere I went, he said, "Just a minute," and they were talking away, and then he said, "This lady here wants you to tell her how to become a Christian." Just like that. So everywhere I went, although I didn't go to preach the gospel, people were coming to the Lord, but particularly through the Africans. They're really tremendous evangelists. They're reaching out. They have a real vision, and not only are they reaching out, while I was at that place where Thomas is, Isaiah came over there and he walked 5 kilometres across the valley to another hillside. I could just see it in the distance. And he was there that evening, and he walked in the next morning, and James is embracing him and saying, "You're a good servant of the Lord, Isaiah. You're a good servant of the Lord." I said, "What's going on, James?" He said, "Oh, Isaiah's just come from across the valley there. And he led 7 to the Lord there last night. 4 women and 3 men. And they were pretty heavy drinkers, this crowd of people, evidently. And the next day, some of those new converts walked across like 5 kilometres to be at the meetings that I was having there. So this will give you some idea of what's happening. The work is just growing. There's churches are being planted almost as many churches being planted as we're seeing people saved. Now we are seeing continued blessing at Lamuran. It's very encouraging to see the work growing there. People are getting saved, but nothing compared to what's happening over there. And they are reaching out. So I said, "What will happen, Isaiah?" I said, "You'll have to start a new church there." He said, "Yes, that will be a new church. We will send somebody in there to shepherd that group, and that will be a new church." So this is just some of the things that's happening. I was able to meet with some registered churches in that area. There are a few. There are some 10. I wasn't aware that they were there, but through Daniel O'Ching, I was able to meet with them, and I had some teaching. I did have a very bad round of dysentery, and felt I had to get out for a while. And so I went back to Rongo, where the Catholics have what they call the Bishop's House, which I was able to rent, where there is a cold shower and a flushing toilet, which is quite a modern con for that part of the world. And I have a few days rest, and then Daniel gave me another interpreter, a chap called Walter, and I went down among assemblies, and I had nearly 2 weeks of teaching. I got down to a place called Manga, and they had some teaching. It's a new work, and they've just branched out with another 6 or 8 people. And while I was there, 2 brothers came to the meeting, new contacts, and they said, "We want to start a work in our town as well." And so it's just growing like that in that little area of Manga, which is also down on Lake Victoria, or very close to Lake Victoria. I was able to start 2 clinics, one at Manga and one at Nagashio. And the one at Nagashio came about because when I arrived, first went in there, the first morning with James on Wandu, there was a girl, his niece, on their little farm. The old couple had their little grass hut here, and then the brothers built out beside. And they're all living on these little farms. This one little farm supporting 15, 20 people. And there was a little girl there, 14-year-old, Lynette, and she was dying with some infection in a leg. Her leg was in a terrible state. And I went into this absolutely filthy little hut. It was so dark I couldn't see, hardly see in there. And I began to give her my antibiotics. And then I found that day there was a nurse there. He couldn't get work because they want a $1,000 bribe to get a job in the hospital. Bribery's everywhere. and he didn't have the money. He's just moved in there. He was actually with the SDAs. He had left them with, and just married Gladys, his new wife, little wife, with him. And he was starting to farm a little bit of ground. He was leasing and living in this tiny little mud hut. And so we went into Kisii, which was an hour and a half, and bought $110. He said, look, you just buy the medicines you want. Oh, he said, about 3,500 shillings. Well, that's about $80. I said, where do you get those? And then he came out a bit later and he said, well, it's going to be a bit more. I said, how much? He said, about 4,500. I said, that'll be all right. So we had these two big boxes of medicines. So they've established a clinic in Nagashio and another one in Manga. And these are on trial. I'm just going to see how they go. I could probably set up another four of these where there are nurses. You can only set them up where there are nurses. Well, Jeffrey is very good. He really knows the tropical diseases. And I came back a month later, just before I came back to Australia, and the clinic was operating quite well. They were renting a little one mud hut with two rooms. Jeffrey and his wife one side and the clinic the other. It's just mud walls. It's got a galvanised iron skillion roof. He's got a little bit of a bed in there, a bit of a curtain, and he's got a little table and a chair where he consults with the patients. And they put a stool outside, and they've got Nagashio Medical Clinic, New Testament Church, P.O. Box, so-and-so, Ogembo. And that's a great big sign up on the clinic, and people lining up there, and lives are being saved through that work. And they're giving chickens or beans or maize to pay, because most of them don't have any money. If they do have some money, they can pay that way, but if they don't have any money, they'll bring a chicken. But the problem I see is, what do they do when somebody comes along and they don't have any money or any chickens? What are they going to do then? It's very hard, isn't it? Because that way their funds are going to run down. And if they're anything like me, you wouldn't be able to say no, would you? You'd want to save that life if you could. So that's one of the things. The one at Manga, there's a lady there, Robber. She started she and another sister were really the driving force behind getting that assembly going at Manga, another new work. And Robber is the fourth wife of Joshua. So these are some of the situations you run into in Kenya. And of course, when they become Christians, we teach them that they're only to marry one wife, they're not to take more. But of course, if they have four wives, what do you do? Well, through the influence of Rhoda, her husband Joshua is actually in fellowship. The other three wives go to other churches. But that's one of the situations that I run into. But Rhoda is a real spiritual, what would you call it, little ball of fire, the way she moves for God. You can just see it in her. She's really on the ball. And she, I gave her 5,000 shillings, which is a bit over $100. And there is a nurse there, a sister in that meeting, who is a trained nurse. She's actually working for the government, and they have set up a clinic there just for the believers. So I'm going to be interested to see how that one goes as well. Now, can I tell you a little bit about the ladies and how they cook and that sort of thing? Would you like to know about that? All right. Well, James Onwandu is 28, his wife Lucy is 21. They have two little girls, Mildred, who is 6, and Jasmus, who is about 3. Her old house is a little round mud hut, which is about probably no more than 15 feet across, if it's that, with a little very steep thatch roof, one door, maybe one window. And that's now the cookhouse. She has three round stones about that big. It's a bit hollow in between them, and she sits the pots on those stones. She probably has three or four pots. I gave her mine. It was too big for me, and I bought a saucepan with a handle. I found one of those in a shop, a smaller one, but I gave her my round cooking pot, which I bought. They're aluminium. They just have a curl lip. It's about an inch round, and she just crouches down there, putting the firewood underneath and cooking. Now, what do they cook? They cook ugali. Now, ugali is maize. They grow the maize and they get it ground up, and that's their staple diet. They grow some navy beans, so occasionally they'll have navy beans for me, being a very special guest, and they only do this rarely because they don't have many chickens. The chickens are free range. They're a tough native breed. They're red, about an average size chicken. And you see them running around with half a dozen little chickens following them, just pecking the insects and that. And for me, occasionally, or normally if I visited a place, they would put on a meal for me. It's part of the culture, and it's very special. The men all sit around the table with me. The ladies eat in another room somewhere. And they'll cook up ugali, they'll cook up chicken, they'll kill it and cook it straight away. They'll cut it up into pieces and boil it. And they may, if they've got a bit of onion, they'll put that in, a little bit of tomato to flavour it. And they call that the soup. The water on it's the soup. And you really need soup to eat ugali. To me, it's flavourless stuff. You try just boiling water and keep putting cornmeal in it until it gets very thick like a pudding, you know, really quite stiff like a bread. And the way they eat it, the ladies bring it all in, and generally the lady will give thanks for the meal, and then there will be the ugali, there will be the chicken, and they have what they call squimawiki, and that's a vegetable. It's like a cabbage plant. It grows tall and it has leaves on it, but it's not really a cabbage, but it looks like a cabbage. And they cut those up like we cut cabbage, very fine, and they boil it up. And that's a great favourite with them. It's slightly bitter to me, but it's palatable, and it's green. So I ate it. I told them when I arrived that I had to eat mostly my own food, and I brought my own food with me, because I don't think I could survive for very long on their cooking. And also, they don't have much hygiene, you know. They just, after I've had a meal, I've seen them just put all the pots outside overnight. Well, if you saw their dogs, how mangy and skinny they are, and that's all out overnight. And so I said to them, I can only eat cooked, well-cooked food, and then I'd get my own plate, and in the kitchen she'd have a few cooking pots, she'd have a few enamel plates, a few mugs, there would be some spoons and a couple of knives for cutting up. They don't eat with knives and forks as we do. And that's about all that's in the kitchen. In the corner there's a stone water jar, and Lucy, the men never do this. I really gave the men a hard time. I tell you what, I was a great favourite with the ladies, because I really got into Ephesians 5, and I told the African men that, you know, this idea of your wives walking two or three steps behind you has got to stop. I said, you know, they are one with you. You are one, two shall become one. And I gave them quite a bit of teaching, and they received it very well. Of course, their culture, this is their culture. But Lucy, she will walk down, it's so steep, down into the gully, and I mean it's steep, it's nearly half a kilometre down there, and I went down the first day I was there and carried water up. Now, men never do that. Here I am with two plastic buckets. It's all I could do to step from one rock to the other to get down. And she'll come up that hill with a 20 litre water container on her head, just one hand on it like that, straight as a ramrod. She's 21 and she's only about 5'4". And she'll carry that up. And there's a little spring down there where she gets the drinking water that goes in the stone container, and in the other corner there's a big plastic drum about 60-70 litres, and she carries that up from the running water from the creek, which is for washing. And she kept my two buckets full, which I use for washing myself, and I always put Dettol in it, because everything's in that water. Let me tell you, goodness knows what's in it. I put plenty of Dettol in it. And also the spring water, even they boil it. All water, every place you go in Kenya, you have to boil it. And so on my little kerosene stove, I bought a kettle, and whenever I made a cup of tea, which I did very often, by the way, the tea is very good in Kenya, very nice tea. They grow a lot of tea. I went through the high country where they grow the tea. It's really beautiful red soil. And so that's a little bit about Lucy in the kitchen. In the kitchen, she'll have a wooden table with a few chairs around it. And then when we have the meal, as I said, they bring it in. One of the ladies will give thanks, and then they'll bring in a plastic jug with fairly hot water in it, a basin and soap. And not always soap, but I generally said, have you got any soap? Because you wash your hands, and as they tip the water over your hands, it's almost biblical, isn't it, eh? You wash your hands. The Bible really come alive. I found the culture really fitted the Bible a lot better than over here. And so I wash my hands, they tip water over, and then she'll go right around all the fellows, they wash their hands, and then they would always give me the best. They'd start putting this chicken out. I know there's only one chicken there, but they'd always give me the two legs. Then they'd start to give me more. Look, I'm an old man, I can't possibly eat all of that. this chicken, how's it going to go around? Well, I tell you, they ate every bit of that chicken, all the legs, everything that was in it. They went through that. Then the ugali, I would cut a piece off and put it in, and they'd come on, I must have some soup, and they'd ladle this soup into the plate, and a bit of squimawiki, and that's our meal. Well, the men, they just eat with their hands, because as I said to them, you were right doing that, I'm right at home here, I can chew my bones and get away with it. What I can't do at home, I can do here. So they're eating their bones, and they just throw them on the table, no tablecloths, nothing like that, and then they eat in from the side all around this ugali. They're all coming in till they meet in the middle eating the ugali. So that's how they do it. Well, I didn't do it that way. I had my spoon and my knife and my fork there, and I looked after myself pretty carefully. I then moved down to George Siso after I'd been a month there, and I got there in time for Easter meetings. Now, leaders came in again from all over. Again, they didn't have the money to feed them, and so I bought the food. Up at James on Wonder, I bought 2 bags of rice, 100 kilos of rice. I bought he wanted oil. They have a 10 litre container. It looks like margarina. They call it fat, and that's what they cook in. And they love rice. That's a delicacy among the Kisi people. So I bought that for them. I spent about $100 and I fed all the leaders that were there. But I found out later I'd fed nearly all the Christians as well. So they were all living on rice while I was there. When I got down to George Siso again, he said that we just don't have the money. He said, we've been working on this for months to get all the leaders here. Now I realised they're travelling, they're walking. One chap walked for 2 days. He said he has a heart condition, high blood pressure, he's lame. He walked for 2 days. Now, I gave him his Mataru fare to get home, and I went to that particular church. There's 40 in fellowship, and it's only 2 years old, that church, and they're all new Christians. And I was with them for a weekend. It's an outreach from the James on Wandu churches. There are 10 churches outreached from the one Nagasho, the original one, where I was telling you Rex and Marco went in and gave out Bibles. 10 new assemblies, and they're planting more. Well, down at George Sisu, we had leaders come in from 20 churches. We ended up with 24 churches wanting registration. Churches have to register in Kenya and in Tanzania. Now, we're right near the Tanzanian border. I walked up to the border post by the invitation of the local sergeant of police. Turned out to be a Christian. And he wanted me to go down to Lake Victoria and then head up north. The roads would be unimaginable. To have meetings at his church where he lives. It would be a long way away, probably be 3 hours driving to get there. I was unable to do it. But this is what was happening. Men were coming out of the woodwork. They came from Tanzania. They came probably for 100 kilometres into Tanzania. And I had leaders from about 18 to 20 churches there, with some who couldn't get there. The Sukuma people down at Mwanza, that's at the south of Lake Victoria in Tanzania, about 300 kilometres from the border. They couldn't get there. There's 2 assemblies of Sukuma believers that want registering. We've got to organise that through the brethren in Tanzania. But there are all up 8 churches represented from Tanzania, 2 Sukuma, the rest are Luo tribe. One of those speaks is a Swahili-speaking assembly. James Omwandu's people are all Kisi. The George Siso people are all Luo. It's one of the biggest tribes in Kenya, the Luo tribe. 2 years ago they were fighting on the borders where the Kisi and the Luo meet, along the border, just out of Rongo. I met a young man, Augustus, a street boy he was until he got converted. And he's got a little orphanage there, and they have a little school for children, orphans and children of single mothers. And he showed me a scar on his head where he got hit with a machete, and his little hut got burnt down. Now that was 2 years ago, and yet here now are believers from the Kisi people sending missionaries out and planting churches among the Luo people. I actually went to one at a place called Kodonga, planted by a Kisi man called Moses Kayamunji. Moses travels on the Matatu for about 2 or 3 hours to get down there, leaves his wife, his young wife, and 2 little children to look after the Shamba. And he's planted there in a little over 12 months. There's a church of nearly 40 believers in that place, and I was able to meet with them and have teaching there. And So back with George Ciso, we had the meetings there over Easter. We had leaders from 18 to 20 churches represented, and again we're under the gum trees. We're just sitting out. They've made a big shelter. They've stood up some rough bits of poles and short pieces across, and they've got gum leaves on the top. And then because of the sun getting through, I've got a major problem with skin cancer, so they'd roll out like a mat on top of that to keep the sun off me. And they'd carry the best chair they had for me to sit on, my interpreter on one side, George Ciso on the other, and the leaders were there, and we would have two-hour sessions a day of teaching, plus the night, sitting, talking, and meetings of the night. And that started Thursday, Easter Thursday, Friday, Good Friday, Saturday and Sunday. And we went right through things like leadership, eldership, teaching on elders, teaching on the ministry of men and women in the local church, baptism, the Lord's Supper. And then we have question times after all of these sessions. I would speak for an hour, I'd really be tired, and then I'd say, any questions? That would give me time to have a drink of water. The Africans go all day with hardly a drink. But this white man, he's always drinking. He's a funny fellow, this white man. And my sense of humour came into play there. So I'd have a little drink of water and really enjoy it, and they'd all laugh and grin. I said, now while I'm having this, you think, any questions? And then the questions would come, very intelligent questions, things like on the Sabbath, why do we meet on Sunday, not the Sabbath? Now that could take half an hour, three quarters of an hour to explain that to them. Tongues, why don't we speak in tongues? And this would go on and on and on. What do we do? A man here has more than one wife. What do we do in this situation? Female mutilation, what do we do among the Kissy people? So we had to go through that with them. And this is quite public. Their wives often were there too. And the questions would come and we would go on. 2-hour sessions, twice a day, among the believers. Easter Saturday night, I felt I had to preach the gospel. Now, it's just grass huts with a tree, with a branch hanging out, with a kerosene pressure lamp hanging there, and they've got a table set up for me with chairs, and then all the men bring the chairs out and sit there, and the women are sitting on the ground or a little still if they've got it. It was quite interesting to see this. And then the little children, there must have been, I counted 20 heads. They'd be from 2-year-old up to about 10. Their little white eyes, white teeth showing, the little round, very tight curly hair. They all cut their hair as close as anything, men and women. They all very, very tight curly hair. And that night I felt I should preach the gospel, so I spoke on Luke chapter 15, the lost things, the foolishly lost sheep, the helplessly lost coin, a dead thing, helpless, the willfully lost son, and then the religiously lost son. And I said at the close, if anyone wants to talk to me about becoming a Christian, I'm going up to my room and I'll be up there. And I was really tired. I tell you, it was tough going, all the meetings I was taking. So I went up there and they carried on talking away in their language, and I'm up there and I'm just sitting back and I make myself a cup of tea. And I'm just relaxing, and my interpreter, William, comes in and he says, Albert, aren't you coming out? I said, what do you want? He said, there's a lot of people out here who want to receive the Lord. And I walked out, there's about 15 people standing out there, and I had to go over the scriptures with them and pray with them, and 15 bowed their heads and asked the Lord to be their saviour that night. That church has had a big influx and it's continuing to grow. There was about 45 in fellowship, and I've got a letter from George not long after I got back. He said there's over 60 now and they need more Bibles. While I was there, a couple of ladies came to me. They have a ladies committee, and this will interest you. This group, George Ciso and some of his family and friends, 2 years ago they left the Worldwide Church of God, the Seventh Day, that's Herbert Armstrong's, under conviction. And they've been meeting and under trees and in their homes, and they've been copying it from the community. Who are you, young men? You know, why don't you join the Catholic Church or the Seventh Day? There's churches everywhere, you know, but they're not really preaching the gospel. So they, my visit gave them a new standing in the community. I had the local chief, and he's the administrator, government representative, his name is Albert, don't ask me the second name. He came along to meetings. He turned out to be a Christian. and he gave a speech, and we gave him a Bible. I was able to give out 570 Bibles. Now, that's what they requested before I, when I arrived in Nairobi. I had a list from them of how many Bibles and the languages they wanted. And through the gifts of the Lord's people, I was able to meet that. But, you know, when we got there, I found it wasn't enough because these churches are growing so rapidly. They didn't have a hymn book among them. So I was able to give them, I worked out one hymn book to three. You know, three people can look on a hymn book. And I didn't know Elaine's home holding the fort. I don't know what money, what gifts have come in. I don't know what money's in MasterCards. I thought, I'm going to get these extra Bibles. So I had to buy extra Bibles and extra hymn books. So I ended up, the Lord met all those needs. When I got home, I didn't know anything. Isn't it wonderful? So I was able to meet the hymn books, 280 hymn books I bought. And I also was able to get three bicycles for the evangelists. And just a couple of points before I close, I was able to get down to Lake Victoria. I had a weekend on Lake Victoria. It was 31 kilometres from George Siso's church at Mgongo. And the new work there, it's only been going 12 months, probably 15 in fellowship, and they bought 5 acres of land on Lake Victoria. It'd be worth millions over here. It's absolutely beautiful. It slopes down and great big granite boulders on one side, a great big bluff runs out into the lake, and you walk over that down and there's all the fishing nets spread out on a big lawn and the dhows, you know, the Arab type dhows, they sail in there and they've got their little white bait, the women spread it out on the nets and they catch the tilapia and the Nile perch there. It's a fishing area. And they've got 5 acres right down to the water, and they've built 3 little grass huts on it, and that's where they have a school. They started a school for the children there, and they said when I was leaving, I was there for a weekend, and we broke bread together for the first time, as we do, you know, with the brothers all taking part. It was a new thing for them. I had to teach them all of this and go through it with them. And as I was leaving this, one of the elders came to me. He said, "See all this? This is all yours, Brother Albert. You can build your house here and you can bring your wife over." I said, "I'll have to have a talk to her about that." "And you can help us. We want a hospital here, and we want a school, and we want our chapel." And that was just one of the things there. So what are their needs? Well, the ladies that came to me at Mgongo, they said, when we left the Seventh Day Worldwide Church of God, we had to leave our sewing machines and everything behind. Can you get us some sewing machines? Well, I wasn't able to get them any sewing machines. I did buy some needle and thread and cloth for them at Nigashio. They've got none of that. Their clothes are old, they're very poor. Many of them, their shoes are worn out, stuff that we'd be throwing in the rubbish bin. But that's how they live. But I tell you what, they've got a wonderful faith. And I think it was a great privilege to be amongst them.